And I obviously, you know, I have 1,000 voicemails to listen to right now. We obviously can't respond.
Just like I said, you spread misinformation and you don't know what to say back to me. Like I said, anything that you say, I can debunk. You spread misinformation, you lie. Masks do not work.
So we have peer-reviewed RCTs. Masks work.
That's a lie. Vaccinations don't work. That's a lie.
Vaccinations do. So is it, well, he sounds linguistically confused. He's saying vaccinations don't work. That's a lie. Anyway, vaccinations obviously work very well. You're 97 times more likely to die of COVID if you're unvaccinated.
The election was stolen. That's true.
The election was not stolen. There's not even evidence that a single state was stolen.
Donald Trump was the greatest president of all time. That's true.
No evidence of that, for sure.
Everything that I could say, I could back up. What about you? Like I said,
it's funny how people think asserting something is backing it up.
Yes. I done gave you my number and everything else. So for me and you to go live on your channel, on your little show, and debate. And I can prove to you that you're bull. And that's all you do is spread misinformation. Lies.
I like the woman in the background yelling lies. And then he says, lies. Yes, that's exactly it. What a chaotic situation, huh?
Yeah, you'll take everybody else's voicemail. Stupid shit about you leaving the country. I don't give a fuck whether you leave or you stay or you.
The person in the background feeding him lines is, I mean, you could, if this was a skit, you could not script it any better.
I mean, oh, well. Like I said, all the shit you talk about Trump, instead of playing Trump bingo, why don't you debunk shit that he's saying? Saying, nope, that's a lie. This is what really happened.
That's what we do.
You can't. You sit there and play Trump bingo. What about Biden and the Democrats? And you can sit there and say that you're not a Democrat all you want to.
I mean, it's quite literally the truth. I've never been a Democrat.
You're a f***ing Democrat.
Oh, okay.
A liberal Democrat. A communist, socialist Democrat.
Meanwhile, the left is like, David, you really should be a socialist. Why aren't you a socialist?
And if you ask me why and ask me the policies like you like to ask everybody else, get me live on your show and I'll make you look stupid about the communists and socialist.
I would love it for someone to make me look like a communist. Like the first question would be, tell me one communist policy that I support. Anyway, that guy sounds like he's got a lot going on. I won't deny that it might be actually fun if he called in. So hopefully he will call in during live calls. We're going to talk about what is happening with the Beijing Olympics on today's bonus show. Very low viewership. And also the quarantine hotels are being called quarantine hell. It's crazy what is happening. We will also talk about alcohol returning to flights in the U.S. and concerns among flight attendants groups about it. I would be concerned. We'll talk about all of those stories and more on today's bonus show. Sign up at Join.
WRCT in sound from way out.
Those of you concerned with your health and the new USDA organic product standards, WRCT Pittsburgh would like to inform you that all RDJs are genetically modified to bring you best music.
Nuclear Holocaust. It's a very serious problem, and one that faces all of us. Fortunately, here at WRCT Pittsburgh, we broadcast from a steel-reinforced concrete basement. So we'll be playing music long after your sorry corpse has evaporated in a blinding flash of light and heat. I hope this thought comforts you. WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Now and forever.
WRCT.
Do you think I'm hot? You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
I have been very, very straightforward and blunt with President Putin, both on the phone and in person. We will impose the most severe sanctions that have ever been imposed.
As President Biden threatens to impose sweeping sanctions against Russia if it invades Ukraine, we'll host a debate on the sanctions being considered in Congress. Could they backfire and increase the chances of war? Then don't look up. The hit film, A Parable About the Climate Emergency, has just nabbed 4 Oscar nominations.
This is not real. This is not real. This is not real.
This isn't happening.
Kate, tell me this isn't really happening.
I hear there's something you don't like the looks of.
We discovered a very large comet.
Oh, good for you. It's headed directly towards Earth.
We'll speak to David Sirota. He just was nominated for an Academy Award for the screenplay of Don't Look Up. We'll also look at a major labor victory in Mexico, where GM workers voted to join an independent union. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. High-level diplomatic talks continued Tuesday amidst ongoing tensions on the Russia-Ukraine border. In Kiev, French President Emmanuel Macron signaled some progress during his talks one day earlier with Russian President Vladimir Putin, but the Kremlin quickly rebuffed any claims that Moscow had made any commitments towards de-escalation. Russia's preparing to begin 10 days of military drills in Belarus, with some 30,000 combat troops expected to participate. Meanwhile, Macron, German Chancellor Olaf Scholz, and the Polish President Duda put on a unified front against Russia during a joint news conference Tuesday. This is President Macron.
Et nous allons continuer d'agir dans les semaines qui viennent.
We will continue to act in the coming weeks with simple objectives. The first one, it has been said, avoiding war. The peace and stability of the European continent are treasured by us, and we believe our duty is to do whatever is in our power to preserve it.
The European leaders also warned again of wide-reaching consequences if Russia invades Ukraine. President Biden's also threatened to impose sweeping sanctions on Russia after headlines will host a debate on U.S. sanctions being considered by Congress. New York's become the latest Democrat-led state to drop some of its COVID restrictions, lifting its indoor mask or vaccine mandate for businesses starting today. Governor Kathy Hochul has not yet announced the future of New York schools' mask mandate, which is set to expire in 2 weeks. Pfizer announced a projected $32 billion in revenue this year from its publicly funded COVID-19 vaccine. That's just part of Pfizer's overall projected revenue of around $100 billion in 2022, with another $22 billion coming from the sale of its COVID pill, Paxlovid. Pfizer's refused to share its technology with other countries in desperate need of vaccines. Oxfam said in response to Pfizer's financial report, quote, "Thousands of people in Africa are dying every day from COVID because companies like Pfizer have prioritized profits over saving lives. No corporation should decide who lives and who dies," they said. In other vaccine news, Johnson & Johnson's halted production of its coronavirus vaccine. The Dutch plant making the only usable doses of the shot switched over to production of an experimental vaccine unrelated to COVID. The pause, which started at the end of last year, is expected to last a few months. Many African nations, as well as the COVAX distribution program, rely heavily on J&J's one-dose vaccine. Canadian truck drivers protesting COVID restrictions and vaccine mandates temporarily shut down traffic on a bridge linking Canada with the U.S. city of Detroit Tuesday. The action sparked concerns over supply chains for the auto industry if protests continue to grow. The mayor of Ottawa Sunday declared a state of emergency over the so-called Freedom Convoy, whose organizers have been linked to far-right and neo-Nazi movements. Meanwhile, plans for a similar convoy in the U.S. are being discussed on social media. In the occupied West Bank, Israeli forces have killed three Palestinians in the city of Nablus. Eyewitnesses said an Israeli soldier shot at their car after storming into the victim's neighborhood in a civilian vehicle. Gunshots were heard for over one straight minute. Rights groups condemned the attack. This is a Palestinian official speaking on Tuesday.
This is just another new crime and a new massacre. Nothing strange from the Israeli government. This is the true face of Israel. Forces, occupation, and settlers rule in Israel, and their government leader is a settler. So definitely there will be catastrophic results on the ground, but we will not allow them to kill our nation's children in the light of day when they are innocent, to kill them in cold blood. This is a crime.
The World Food Program is warning some 13 million people in the Horn of Africa are facing severe hunger due to persistent drought exacerbated by the climate crisis. Inflation and an increase in the cost of food have further compounded the problem, and people have been forced to leave their homes amid security concerns and regional conflict. In Ethiopia, more than 6 million people will require urgent humanitarian assistance by mid-March, according to the UN. In Somalia, over 7 million people need urgent aid.
We haven't had the last two rainy seasons. We never experienced this before. We only see dust storms now. We are afraid that they will cover us all and become our graveyard, like what happens in the desert.
The Biden administration's approved a possible $100 million sale of military equipment and services to Taiwan, including its Patriot missile defense system. The main suppliers are Raytheon and Lockheed Martin. China condemned the news, which comes amidst ongoing tensions between Beijing and Washington and between Beijing and Taipei. In India, schools in the southern state of Karnataka have shut down as protests grow over a recent decision to ban hijabs and burqas in colleges. A social media video showing a hijab-wearing student being harassed at a college has further intensified the outrage over anti-Muslim persecution in Karnataka, whose local government is ruled by the right-wing Hindu nationalist BJP party. Muslim students gathered in protest Monday.
We will enter the classroom wearing our hijabs. We will not remove the hijabs until we receive an order from the High Court.
Former Pope Benedict asked for forgiveness following a recent report that found he failed to act in at least four cases of sexual abuse by priests when he was the Archbishop of Munich. Benedict, however, denied having knowledge of or covering up any abuse. The report identified at least 235 sexual predators, along with around 500 survivors, spanning a period of over 50 years. In Australia, former government staffer and rape survivor Brittany Higgins said she wanted to see more action as she slammed the apology offered this week by Australia's Prime Minister Scott Morrison for her attack and the culture of sexual abuse in Parliament. Last year, Higgins accused a former colleague of raping her inside a minister's office, setting off a major reckoning at the highest levels of Australian government. She spoke earlier today at the National Press Club in Canberra.
What bothered me most about the whole imagine if it were our daughter's spiel wasn't that he necessarily needed his wife's advice to help contextualize my rape in a way that mattered to him personally. All he could do, and that's how he realized it was a bad thing, I didn't want his sympathy as a father. I wanted him to use his power as Prime Minister.
The University of California has agreed to pay over $243 million to settle lawsuits by more than 200 women who accused former UCLA gynecologist Dr. James Heaps of sexual abuse. The settlement does not cover another 300 former patients who are also suing over Heaps' crimes. Dr. Heaps is facing criminal charges involving at least seven of the survivors. In related news, three Harvard graduate students have filed a lawsuit accusing the Ivy League University of ignoring for years their sexual harassment accusations against anthropology professor John Komaroff, who threatened to ruin their academic careers if they reported him. In California, the Oakland School Board overnight voted to close 2 schools this year and 5 more in 2023. The board's decision came just before 1 in the morning Wednesday, after about 8 hours of emotional public comment and debate from board members. The board's plans drew widespread condemnation from students, teachers, and parents, who held several actions leading up to Tuesday's vote to pressure the board to keep the schools open. Community advocates say the move would disproportionately affect Black and Latinx students in low-income areas of Oakland. A group of teachers went on hunger strike over a week ago in protest. To see our interview with one of those hunger strikers, go to democracynow.org. The Biden administration blasted a new anti-LGBTQ plus bill making its way through the Florida legislature, with President Biden calling the legislation hateful. The so-called Don't Say Gay bill, which would ban all discussions of sexual orientation and gender identity in schools, was approved by Florida's Senate Education Committee Tuesday after Governor Ron DeSantis came out in support of the measure. Immigrant justice advocates are denouncing reports the Biden administration plans to expand its use of home confinement and to launch a pilot curfew program to monitor undocumented immigrants awaiting court hearings. The move is said to be part of an effort to decrease the use of private immigration jails. But rights advocates say the U.S. government's not only incarcerating more immigrants, but also growing more reliant on ankle bracelet monitors and other surveillance devices as so-called alternatives to detention. Axios reports, as of last week, there were nearly 180,000 immigrants subjected to these practices, though the actual number may be much higher, as current figures only account for the head of a household registered in such programs. And Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell condemned the Republican National Committee's decision to censure Congressmembers Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger for being part of the House investigation into the January 6th Capitol attack.
The issue is whether or not the RNC should be sort of singling out members of our party who may have different views from the majority. That's not the job of the RNC.
McConnell rebuked the RNC's characterization of January 6th as legitimate political discourse, saying, quote, "We saw it happen. It was a violent insurrection for the purpose of trying to prevent the peaceful transfer of power after a legitimately certified election," McConnell said. House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy, meanwhile, defended the RNC's move. McCarthy has refused to cooperate with the House committee's investigation and faces a possible subpoena. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. When we come back, we host a debate about sweeping U.S. sanctions on Russia being considered by Congress. Could they backfire and increase the chances of war? Stay with us. Peace, composed by Jesse Montgomery, performed by Elena Uriosti and Tom Poster. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez in New Brunswick, New Jersey. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
The Biden administration's threatening to impose sweeping sanctions on Russia if Vladimir Putin orders an invasion of Ukraine. Russia's reportedly stationed over 100,000 troops on the Ukrainian border, but Putin's repeatedly denied he plans to invade. The crisis has led to high-level diplomatic talks this week in Moscow, Kiev, and Washington. On Monday, President Biden discussed possible sanctions during a joint news conference with Germany's new chancellor, Olaf Scholz, at the White House.
It would be a gigantic mistake for him to move on Ukraine. The impact on Europe and the rest of the world would be devastating, and he would pay a heavy price. I have been very, very straightforward and blunt with President Putin, both on the phone and in person. We will impose the most severe sanctions that have ever been imposed, economic sanctions. And there will be a lot to pay for that down the road.
On Capitol Hill, a bipartisan group of senators are also weighing new legislation to impose sanctions on Russia. Senate Foreign Relations Committee Chair Senator Robert Menendez of New Jersey spoke recently on MSNBC.
The legislation that I drafted, which I call the mother of all sanctions bill, is one to deter Russia and says all of these things will happen. Putin personally sanctioned, Russia's sovereign debt sanctioned, sectoral elements of their economy, including the single most significant one, their energy sector, removal from SWIFT, the international financial transaction systems, and others. Is there as a message, if you invade, here's all the consequences you're going to face.
To talk more about possible sanctions against Russia, we host a debate on the issue. We're joined by two guests. George Lopez is professor emeritus of peace studies at the Kroc Institute at the University of Notre Dame. He recently co-authored a piece for the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists headlined How to Mix Sanctions and Diplomacy to Avert Disaster in Ukraine. We are also joined by Marcus Stanley, advocacy director of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. He recently wrote a piece titled, Democrats' Russia Sanction Bill Could Lead to a Diplomatic Disaster. Marcus Stanley, let's begin with you. Why do you oppose sanctions in this case? Why do you think they could lead to a disaster?
Well, to be clear, sanctions could play a role in diplomacy. The threat of sanctions could play a role in diplomacy, and sanctions could be appropriate if Russia actually mounted a full-on invasion of Ukraine. But the legislation that we're seeing in Congress is very different than this. I think that legislation sort of involves a rush to punishment or a rush to impose sanctions on Russia in a way that would be harmful to diplomacy. And specifically, the threshold for sanctions in this legislation is actually much lower than an invasion. This legislation requires, as you heard President Biden say, the largest sanctions in U.S. history to be imposed if Russia does anything aimed at undermining the government of Ukraine or interfering with the sovereignty of Ukraine. That could be well short of an invasion. It could be something like a cyber attack or even a propaganda campaign. And then once this very low threshold is met, the bill requires all of these sanctions to be put in place at once, and it makes them very hard to remove. So I think what we're seeing with this bill is that this legislation could lock us in to full-on economic warfare based on a relatively minor Russian provocation. And once that happens, Russia will have no disincentive to go further. And that's really the opposite of a flexible, calibrated sanctions approach that's subordinated to diplomacy, where the first priority is on reaching a peaceful diplomatic solution, and sanctions are just one tool that you use to try to do that. What we're seeing here is, as I said, prioritizing a punishment for Russia, kind of a rush to economic warfare, even before Russia has invaded. And we do believe there's a path to a peaceful diplomatic solution of this crisis, but this legislation is too extreme and not contributing to that solution.
I'd like to ask George Lopez for his response on this. But first, I wanted to make a correction to our previous segment that we had on Russia last week with Medea Benjamin, where I incorrectly cited the size of the military, U.S. military force in Europe before this crisis. It's the actual size has been between 60 and 80,000 in recent years. The figure I gave was more of the Cold War period. So my apologies for that incorrect assertion. But I wanted to ask George Lopez, your sense, is this a rush to economic warfare by the United States, as Marcus Stanley says?
You know, I'm still not sure of that. I think it is all subject to the implementation by the White House. There's not congressional constraints here as much as a congressional opening and a full picture to the Russians that the U.S. Congress and both parties and the administration, under the ability of the president to impose these kinds of sanctions under AIPA processes, that he can go forward with all of them. I think particularly the writings that we've done about this are interested in seeing the mix of diplomacy and the sanctions in a way that Marcus has characterized, but this bill gives it teeth. There are ways in which to get bipartisan support. I think Menendez, Senator Menendez, added some things to this bill that were not originally in it last week when many of us were writing about this. And there's some things that I disagree with in the bill. But the general thrust and the importance of the consistency of what we find in this sanctions package gives us the very ability to deter the likelihood of a Russian strong military action. When you get to the refinements of whether it would all be imposed under a cyber attack, I think there are ways in which you could do bits and pieces of this legislation in implementation by the president and the allies, and we'll see how that plays out. But in fact, one of the strengths that we found in looking at this mix of material that are now on the table and that the Russians know clearly is they have the greatest strength of deterrence for a couple of reasons. The first is now with the work that's happened diplomatically over the last 3 weeks internally among the allies, everyone's on board, not only in a commitment to enforce, but they played a role in the design of these various packages, including the cyber package. The second is, in doing so, all the allies, including the United States, are willing to accept the costs. Yes, the German chancellor this week kind of waffled on Nord Stream 2, but in fact, they've said yes to the package. They're ready to go forth. And the diplomatic foray you see back and forth with Mr. Putin individually by European leaders, I think, undergirds that. More importantly, what we know from sanctions research and policy in past cases is when you present the multifaceted dynamic of these sanctions and also are going to lead with a very, very strong and effective package, you increase the prospects that the other side, in this case, Mr. Putin and the Russians, actually see what the incurred costs on their side will be, and it opens space for diplomacy. I think our basic message from our research team is that sanctions must work as a deterrent. If they fail as the deterrent, then we're in a whole different ballgame. And so the notion of we're going to about to engage in economic war is a interesting perspective, and I can understand Marcus's perspective. But from our side, you have all the ingredients in an interesting way that success is defined not as imposing the sanctions, but it's actually buying time for this diplomacy, which I think we've seen over the last couple of weeks. And hopefully within the next 30 days, even if the Senate passes this package, we won't have to resort to the sanctions. But their presentation and clarity is consistent with the kind of threat that brings people to the table.
Well, Marcus Stanley, I wanted to ask you to respond, one, on this issue of are the NATO allies unified around these sanctions in practice? Because clearly, Europe has much more to lose in terms of the impact on its economies than the United States does if some of the most powerful of these sanctions are implemented. And also, could you talk about this whole issue of the SWIFT system, the financial system, and the threat to shut it down for Russia, the potential impact that could have on world markets and the international financial system?
That's all correct. I just want to respond quickly on the nature of this legislation in Congress. I Professor Lopez and I have different jobs. His work as a professor is looking at the academic work on sanctions, which I agree sanctions can serve as a deterrent if they're correctly used. My job in Washington, D.C., is to read through this kind of legislation carefully and understand exactly what it does. And I do think that this legislation, the framework for sanctions that it lays out, is very dangerous because it really does set mandate that the president impose the full set of sanctions as an entire package, not calibrated sanction by sanction, but the full set based on a low threshold of Russian provocation. And then it requires a formal agreement with the government of Ukraine to ever lift the sanctions. So we really could find ourselves in this all or nothing situation with and at the mercy of hardliners in Ukraine as to whether we could lift the sanctions. And I don't disagree with what Professor Lopez said about the potential utility of sanctions as a deterrent. But the important thing to understand is the president already has the authority to do that. He doesn't need any new legislation to use sanctions as a deterrent. He has that. So what I'm seeing here is that Congress is pushing the president into a more extreme position than is healthy for the process of diplomacy. Now, in terms of your other two questions, you're absolutely correct that these sanctions could have a very significant economic cost for Europe. And right now, we're sort of holding our European alliance together, I would say barely, in the sense that the Europeans are willing to go along, to have a united front with the use of these sanctions as a deterrent. But if these sanctions actually went into place, especially on that all or nothing basis that I talked about, and especially if they go into place for anything less than a full-scale invasion, Europe is going to start feeling pain very quickly. I mean, energy prices will go up, commodity prices will go up. Russia is a major trading partner of the EU. And one of the things that we could see if we rush to sanctions is that it could eventually end up splitting our alliance and putting a lot of pressure on NATO if these sanctions are in place for a long period of time. And frankly, the sanctions could also have some costs here at home because Russia is the largest commodity exporter in the world, including for commodities like grain. They're the largest exporter in the world. Other important commodities like oil and so on. And we could see inflation in commodity prices around the world if we put sanctions in place for a long period of time. Now, the SWIFT sanctions you talked about, these could, it's true, be devastating to the Russian economy because they basically try to ban a number of Russia's largest banks from dealing in dollars anywhere in the world. And we've never tried to impose this on a country as large as Russia. And that would be very disruptive to Russia's trade relations. I think what it would do is it would damage their economy, damage Russian civilians. It would also force Russia more into the arms of China, because when dollar trade is cut off, I think China is the large economy that could kind of offer Russia a haven there. And I also think that would be a long-term diplomatic cost to the United States as well, driving Russia into the arms of China. So again, I agree, sanctions can be a deterrent. Sanctions will impact the Russian economy. There's no question. They can be a deterrent, but if they're actually put in place for any length of time, they're going to have real costs.
I wanted to stick with you, Mark Stanley, for a second. Of course, sanctions are often talked about as a nonviolent alternative to war. But you look at the history of U.S. sanctions, for example, against Cuba for over 60 years. You look at what happened in Iraq. The Secretary of State at the time, Madeleine Albright, when asked, did she think it was worth the price, 500,000 Iraqi children dead? She said yes, would later apologize. I asked President Clinton about those sanctions and the fact that two UN Assistant Secretaries of the United Nations, Secretary Generals of the United Nations had called them genocidal. He said that's ridiculous. But can you respond to the alternative to sanctions that aren't war? And then we'd like to end with George Lopez. We only have a minute.
Yeah, as I said, sanctions can be thought of as a form of economic warfare. They are enforced by force, and they are a form of economic blockade that would traditionally, I think, have been looked at as part of warfare. And we've seen that they can have devastating impacts on civilian populations. Our sanctions on Afghanistan right now, the UN has said, are directly contributing to food insecurity and potentially starvation for millions of people. So I don't think it's correct to view sanctions as somehow nonviolent. And a final point, another point you made in terms of the Cuba sanctions, you know, sanctions have traditionally not been that effective in getting people to do what you want. We've been sanctioning Cuba for 60 years, North Korea for decades. Those governments are still in place. They're still not doing what we want, but there's have been major impacts on civilian populations.
And George Lopez, your response to that?
I'm completely opposed to sanctions that do have negative humanitarian effects. And we've done a lot of research on this, and I'm involved in a lot of policy work with that. The key, I think, point of agreement between Marcus and myself is if the sanctions have to be imposed because the Russians have engaged in warfare, then sanctions of a deterrent have failed. We find in this particular mix at this moment between allies, the sanctions package, and the aggressive diplomacy that we're waging, that we have a high chance of success. And moving forward with this legislation, even though I don't think myself it's perfect, may be a key component of that. So I think we're on the right track. If war breaks out, not only have sanctions failed, but diplomacy has failed. And then we're in a new ballpark. And if the sanctions are imposed, I'm happy to come back and talk about their likelihood of success.
I want to thank you both for being with us. George Lopez of the University of Notre Dame and Marcus Stanley of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. And just to be clear, when I asked President Clinton, I asked him about the two former or who quit assistant UN Secretary Generals. They were Dennis Halliday and Hans von Sponeck. Next up, Don't Look Up, the hit film, a parable about the climate emergency, has nabbed four Oscar nominations. We'll speak with the journalist and former Bernie Sanders advisor David Sirota, nominated for an Academy Award for the film's screenplay. Stay with us. Don't Look Up, main title suite by composer Nicholas Britell. The soundtrack to Don't Look Up is an Oscar nominee for Best Original Score. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. As we turn to look at a new movie that's been described as giving us a reason to look up during these dire times. The hit satire film, a parable about the climate crisis, Don't Look Up, was nominated Tuesday for four Academy Awards: Best Picture, Best Original Score, Best Film Editing, and Best Original Screenplay, which is interesting because the film was co-written by the longtime progressive journalist David Sirota, who is a Bernie Sanders 2020 campaign advisor and speechwriter. He shares the nomination with the film's director, Adam McKay. Don't Look Up features some of Hollywood's biggest actors, including Meryl Streep as President of the United States, Tyler Perry, and Cate Blanchett as TV news anchors, and Jennifer Lawrence and Leonardo DiCaprio as scientists who try to warn the world about a comet on a direct collision course with Earth. We'll talk with David Sirota about how the film came together in a minute. But first, the trailer.
This is not real. This is not real. This is not real.
This isn't happening.
Kate, tell me this isn't really happening.
I hear there's something you don't like the looks of.
We discovered a very large comet.
Oh, good for you.
It's headed directly towards Earth.
This comet is what we call a planet killer.
At this exact moment, I say we sit tight and assess.
C
sit tight and assess?
Sit tight.
And then assess. The sit tight part comes first, then you got to digest it. That's the assessment period.
This is the worst news in the history of humanity. He just blew us off.
What are we going to do? We have to release the information.
So we just leak it.
Today have made a pretty big discovery in space.
How big is this thing going? I can't destroy my ex-wife's house. Is that possible?
There's a 100% chance that we're all going to die.
Hey.
Hey.
Well, the handsome astronomer can come back anytime, but the yelling lady, not so much.
We're going to get the news out there one way or another.
It's real and it's coming.
Jesus Christ, you could have just called me.
This comet contains $30 trillion worth of material.
What do trillions of dollars matter if we're all going to die?
Oh, no, what if we're rich? That would be terrible.
You guys discovered a comet? I have a tattoo of a shooting star on my back.
Oh, that's terrific. This could be a complete disaster.
This is already a disaster.
That girl from YFTV said we're all gonna die.
No.
Yo, bro! You'll never take me alive! There it is!
Giant comet! Whirling its way towards Earth!
Can you see it?
I can't! My head is in a bag!
I did have the FBI put that bag over your head. They don't do that. The CIA does, but I made them do it.
You know, I had a feeling.
It's a good feeling, because that is what I did, and it was very funny and cool.
That's the trailer for the movie Don't Look Up. For more, we're joined by David Sirota, the award-winning investigative journalist, founder of the news website The Daily Poster, editor-at-large for Jacobin. Welcome back and congratulations on being nominated yesterday for an Oscar for Best Original Screenplay, along with director Adam McKay. David, how did you two come to write this major film? Talk about the response to it. It came out on Christmas Eve. It's already one of the most watched Netflix movies of all time. And McKay credits you with the idea of using an asteroid as a metaphor for the climate crisis.
So Adam McKay and I have been friends for a very long time. And after he made Vice, I was talking with him. Vice is the movie about the Dick Cheney. I said to him, I said, listen, you need to use your superpowers of comedy and mixing comedy with politics. You need to use those superpowers for something about climate. And he said, yeah, I know. I've been trying to figure out how to do something on climate, but I don't really want to do a kind of Mad Max post-apocalyptic dystopia, and I'm trying to figure out what to do. And he and I were commiserating at one point a little while after that about the lack of coverage of climate change. I think I had written a story or sort of reported something about climate change, and I was lamenting how I felt that I sort of said that, you know, climate change, it sort of feels like an asteroid's headed towards Earth and nobody really cares. And he said, wait a minute, maybe there's an idea there. Maybe there's a movie there. And so we started spitballing scenes about, you know, the president and what would actually happen if a comet was headed towards Earth. And he essentially, after we had a bunch of scenes, he went and he wrote a script and he came back with notes. And I kept sort of saying, yeah, are they really going to, you know, I was excited, but I kept saying, are they really going to make this movie? And he said, oh, we got Leonardo DiCaprio and Jennifer Lawrence excited about it. And then all of a sudden he said, we're going to make this movie. We're sending the paperwork over. This is actually happening. And in the middle of COVID, in 2020, the late winter, they made the movie. And I was as shocked as anybody that they actually pulled it off. But I think the movie has had such a great response because I think there is a pent-up demand for content about the climate crisis. This is an allegory for how we're dealing with, or really not dealing with, the climate crisis. And I think people on the screen, they see this movie showing them how ridiculous and destructive our world has become when it comes to dealing constructively with science, in particular climate science.
And David, first of all, I want to congratulate you. My wife and I watched it on Netflix several weeks ago, and we literally could not stop laughing throughout the entire film, and to the point that we were crying at points, that we were laughing so hard. But I wanted to ask you a couple of things. One, the scenes in terms of the media response to the scientists coming on the shows. I wanted to get an idea of how the thought that went into those scenes, and especially the new age executive in the film who comes up with the brilliant idea, supposedly, of mining the comet. And being able to get rare earth minerals out of it in the process.
Well,
who came up with that idea?
The media part, I'll take that for the start. I mean, that was really at the core of everything and the idea, which is that the question that I think we all have to ask ourselves is, are we at a point where the media so frivolizes important information and so tries to distract us from important information that we can't actually act on that information, even when scientists are grabbing us by the lapels and saying we have to act? And I think that in many cases, when it comes to climate science, it really does feel like that the big challenge, among other things, is not just how do we deal with climate change on the policy. I think that we kind of know what we have to do, but how do we actually make climate science salient in the political discourse? And corporate media is really not all that interested in making climate science a central story. So I think that morning show setup in the movie really illustrates that. On the question about mining the asteroid, that was an idea, again, at the beginning that Adam and I were talking about. We when we were kind of spitballing ideas of how ridiculous our world is, we said, you know, if there was an asteroid headed towards Earth, you know that there would be corporations that would be trying to come up with not just how to stop the meteor, but how to profit off of it. And that character, I think, that you see, the Mark Rylance character, is kind of an amalgam of a lot of these tech oligarchs in our society who are constantly saying that they're going to save society. But curiously enough, their proposals for saving society typically end up enriching them, that the alternatives to saving society that don't involve giant corporate profits, that's the kind of stuff that isn't much talked about and isn't much promoted by the most powerful people in our country.
So I want to go to a few clips from Don't Look Up. One, Don't Start Crying. the scientist characters, Dr. Randall Mindy, astronomy graduate student, Kate Dubosky, and Dr. Oglethorpe, played by Leonardo DiCaprio, Jennifer Lawrence, and Rob Morgan, meet the President of the United States, played by Meryl Streep.
This comet is what we call a planet killer.
That is correct.
Mm-hmm. So how certain is this?
There's 100% certainty of impact.
Please, don't say 100%.
Can we just call it a potentially significant event?
Yeah.
Yes.
But it isn't potentially going to happen. It is going to happen.
Exactly. 99.78% to be exact.
Oh, great.
Okay, so it's not 100%.
Well, scientists never like to say 100%.
Call it 70% and let's move on.
But it's not even close to 70%.
You cannot go around saying to people that there's a 100% chance that they're going to die. You know, it's just nuts. And we should get some of our scientists on this, you know, no offense, but you're just two people that walked in here with
Dr. Oglethorpe.
Dr. Oglethorpe.
Well, when the president, Meryl Streep, treats the three scientists dismissively, they take their message to the public. In this scene, the scientists, again, played by Leonardo DiCaprio and Jennifer Lawrence, wait their turn in a green room to come on a morning show to discuss their findings.
Jack and Bree are going to do like 10 on the SCOTUS nominee, and then Riley Bina, you'll come on.
And I get to talk about my single, right? A portion of the profits goes to the manatee sanctuaries.
Yes, but the breakup first. And then Dr. Mindy and Miss Dibioski, you'll come on and talk about that planet you discovered.
Comet, we found a comet.
They know what we're here to talk about, right?
Of course. Jack and Bree love doing science segments. Just remember, keep it light, fun. Jack and Bree love having a good time.
Well, that's not promising.
You guys discovered a comet? That's so dope. I have a tattoo of a shooting star on my back.
That's terrific.
The actress with that tattoo is Ariana Grande. In this next scene from Don't Look Up, the two scientists appear on the morning news show The Daily Rip, hosted by news anchors Bree and Jack, played by Cate Blanchett and Tyler Perry.
How big is this thing? Could it, like, destroy someone's house? Is that possible?
Well, Comet Bibiaski, which is what it will officially be named, is somewhere.
What an honor. Yeah, right. Congratulations.
It's somewhere between 6 and 9 kilometers across. So
it's big.
It would damage the entire planet, not just a house. No.
The entire planet. Okay, well, as it's damaging, will it hit this one house in particular that's right on the coast of New Jersey? It's my ex-wife's house. I need it to be hit. Can we make that happen?
You and Shelley have a great relationship. No, you stop.
Listen, in all
fairness... You need to stop.
I will, but in all fairness, I actually paid for the house.
I'm so sorry.
Are we not being clear? We're trying to tell you that the entire planet is about to be destroyed.
Okay.
Well, it's, just something we do around here. You know, we just keep the bad news light.
Right. It helps the medicine go down.
That's a clip from Don't Look Up, the Netflix blockbuster. David Sirota, our guest. David, how did your experience working with Senator Bernie Sanders influence how you talk about the media? Also, as the president changes, I'm sorry that the first woman president is the lunatic that she is.
Well, the experience of working for Bernie Sanders, I mean, one of Bernie's, criticisms of the media is that the media doesn't take serious issues seriously. And I worked for Bernie 20-plus years ago when on Capitol Hill, and I worked for him on his 2020 presidential campaign. And that criticism of his, I think, you know, he aired that back then. He aired that on the 2020 campaign. He still says it today, and I think it's absolutely accurate. And it's not really about him and how they treat him. It's about how corporate media treats really serious issues of the day. I mean, again, when it comes to something like climate, corporate media, I think, has not taken climate seriously. I mean, I've said this before. I'll say it again. The way to take climate change seriously in news coverage is to bake it into the day-to-day coverage. We know what that looks like. The economy is baked into day-to-day coverage of politics and of our society. Climate is seen at best as a story over here that gets covered once in a while and then kind of goes away. But climate really is everything. I mean, it is the livable ecosystem. Now, and I want to say this. I think Democracy Now, I think independent media is the solution to this. So I just want to be clear that I'm not including Democracy Now and the great work that you do in that. But I think there's an important point there, that corporate media knows who signs its paycheck. It knows what its sponsors really want. And that's part of why these issues don't get the centrality of the coverage that they need to get in our news discourse. And that's why I really believe independent media is so important. It's why I work at the Daily Poster. It's why I love what you guys do. And I think everyone listening needs to understand how important independent media really is.
Finally, I wanted to go to a different issue from your role as a scriptwriter to the Daily Poster and the expose on California single-payer health care going down, your searing critique of the governor there. Could you talk about what happened, David, very quickly?
Sure. Gavin Newsom had campaigned, the governor of California had campaigned on a very explicit promise to lead the fight for single-payer health care. I mean, he was extremely explicit about that. He said he was actually tired of politicians putting it off. A single-payer bill came to the California Assembly, a serious single-payer bill. Gavin Newsom, this is a couple weeks ago, Gavin Newsom all of a sudden went silent and then started making comments as if he was hedging, as if he was backing off. Well, what happened in the middle of that? Well, what we reported at the Daily Poster was a large health insurance company dumped $1 million into the California Democratic Party, and other health insurers gave him, his campaign, and the California Democratic infrastructure lots of money. And ultimately what happened was the California Democratic Assembly did not allow a full vote on that single payer bill. So in my view, the story is somebody went out and campaigned on something, a huge amount of money went in, and then out came an outcome of killing the bill. That's what we reported at Daily Poster.
And you're changing the name of Daily Poster, David?
Yes, we're soon going to be the lever. We're going to be expanding. I hope people will check us out, dailyposter.com. By the way, we have a special, if people want to subscribe, a special discount for all Democracy Now! Listeners. You can find it at dailyposter.com/democracynow. We believe in supporting independent media, and I just want to congratulate you, Amy and Juan, seriously. I rely on you so much for an inspiration and for your daily reporting. It is the antidote to the kinds of things that we show in this movie, Don't Look Up.
Well, David, thanks so much for being with us. David Sirota, award-winning investigative journalist, founder of the news website The Daily Poster, editor-at-large for Jacobin, served as advisor and speechwriter for Senator Bernie Sanders during his presidential campaign, has just been nominated for an Oscar for Best Original Screenplay for the Netflix blockbuster Don't Look Up. He shares a nomination with the film's director, Adam McKay. The film also nominated for Best Picture, Best Original Score, and Best Film Editing. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. In a historic victory for international labor rights, thousands of Mexican workers at the General Motors plant in Mexico have voted in a landslide to form an independent union. The union election at the GM plant in the city of Silao in Guanajuato was the first since the implementation of new labor reforms in Mexico written into the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement. Many powerful unions in Mexico with ties to elite politicians and business people had for years gone behind workers' backs to make deals with multinational corporations to keep workers' pay low and deny them other benefits. This is Maria Alejandra Morales Reynosa, the Secretary General of the Independent Union of Workers in the Automotive Industry. Ahead of the vote, she and the union were targeted with threats.
Let's hope those other unions change and work for the actual workers, so they, unions, don't only look out for their own interests. A union has to represent the workers, and I believe we are going to start by making that much-needed change. We still don't know who sent threatening messages. They were not only sent to myself, but to all my committee present here.
GM's own reports show wages for new workers at GM's plant in Silao, who build the Chevrolet Silverado and the GMC Sierra pickups, make about $25 for a 12-hour shift. One of the GM workers, Armando Sandoval, recently spoke to Reuters about how the new union could mean higher wages for workers at the GM plant.
Con ese sindicato que tenemos.
With the union we've had for years, they raised our wage by 14 pesos. Alongside those 14 pesos, they raised transportation, union fees, and cafeteria prices. Practically, we are breaking even year in and year out. We are hoping for many improvements.
By choosing the new independent union, GM workers in Silao have broken ties with one of Mexico's most influential labor organizations, which had held the plant's contract for 25 years. Major U.S. labor unions supported the election. AFL-CIO President Liz Schuler said, quote, "This vote represents a rejection of the past and a new era for Mexican workers' right to associate freely." General Motors says it's ready to enter negotiations with a new independent union. Under the country's reform labor law, the union has 6 months to negotiate a contract approved by a majority of the workers. For more, we go to Guanajuato in Mexico to speak with Javier Bravo, professor of history at the University of Guanajuato. Welcome to Democracy Now!, professor. It's great to have you with us. Talk about the significance of this victory of the independent union in a GM plant in Mexico.
Thank you, Amy. Hello, everyone. Well, this victory of Cynthia's is has a very big symbolic meaning for us in Guanajuato and in Mexico, because 76% of the workers have voted for Cynthia to represent them, before the CEO. And the owners of the plant. That's a huge victory that is like a lighthouse for us, for our labor movement, because for many years here in Guanajuato and in Mexico, the CTM has been controlling the labor movement. It has demobilized the labor movement in Mexico. So this victory is very important, especially because Cynthia, the new union, is like a true workers' union representing workers, because CTM is led by professional, corrupt politicians, not workers. So for the first time in the existence of the plant here in Guanajuato, workers will be representing workers. That's beautiful news. There's some aesthetics in what is happening right now in Guanajuato, especially because the Secretary General of the Cynthia Syndicate Union is a woman. That's another symbolic message to the people and the working class here in Guanajuato. Myself, as a faculty member of the Universidad of Guanajuato, and my colleagues from Mexico Solidarity Project are trying to support Cynthia in all the ways that are possible to us, because they have no means. I mean, the labor quotes, the union quotes, were in the hands of CTM. So Cynthia was born from nothing, just from the will of these rebel workers. We thank all these rebel workers for creating such an inspiring union, Amy.
And Professor Bravo, I'd like to ask you, in terms of the labor reform, most Americans are not aware that these kinds of elections would not even be happening had it not been for the labor reforms that President López Obrador passed shortly after becoming president, that insisted that more than 700,000 union contracts, workers have to be able to vote on their contracts secretly, to vote for their elected officials. What's been the impact of that labor reform that was passed in April of 2019?
Oh, well, I think the results are just in process. We are not seeing the whole picture, but now the conditions and the possibilities of free unions are very important. So they can, for the first time in our labor history in Mexico, they can create new unions independently of the will of the owners. For the first time, can you imagine? That was so that means that they can now really in real life struggle, fight for being treated as human beings, not just as objects, as means for the owner's profit, but as human beings, not as human resources, like natural resources. No, they're human beings, and they have now the possibility, the legal possibility, to being treated as human beings. There's a lot of possibilities, not just only to create new unions free of the owner's influence, but also, they can elect the representatives without asking for permission to the patron, to the from the owner. That is a new reality for our labor movement. But also in universities, it could be applied, because in universities, in public universities in Mexico, most of the unions are protection unions, protection for the central administration. So this possibility of using the new labor legislation in Mexico is very give us hope, the hope we did not used to have.
Avir Bravo, we want to thank you so much for being with us as we have to wrap the show. Professor of History at the University of Guanajuato in Mexico. And that does it for our broadcast. Democracy Now! Is currently accepting applications for Human Resources Manager. You can learn more and apply at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Stay safe.
Meaty and full of flavor since 1949.
You're listening to Away with Words, the show about language and how we use it. I'm Grant Barrett.
And I'm Martha Barnett. We got an email from Jan Kutzebel, who is a school principal in the Czech Republic. And he writes, I listen to your show quite often, usually when walking to the school. I even have a place I call Chinesky's Place. This is the place where his quiz always begins, since it comes more or less at the same time from the start of the show. Anyway, he was talking about our conversation that we had about helicopter parents, you know, those parents who tend to hover in their children's lives, and about the fact that in Denmark, they're called curling parents, alluding to the sport of curling and, you know, those frantic efforts to sweep away all the obstacles that are in your children's path.
Yeah.
Well, Jan and his wife, Sharka, decided that they're golf parents. And the way he put it was, we tend to strike our children approximately in the right direction toward the hole and let them fly.
Oh, those are both so perfect. Curling parents, like this well-cared-for stone gliding slowly down the ice. The parents in front frantically brushing away all obstacles. And then golf. Golf, you're just using your best know-how, everything you can to push them in the direction of the hole and the flag and just putting your hand to your eyes to block out the sun just to see if they're going to make it, you know, knowing it's out of your control.
Yeah,
or
maybe
you know,
putting your hand over your eyes.
Yeah, putting your hand over your eyes and just slowly walking behind, trying to catch up to wherever they've gone. Yeah.
Right? Yeah, at some point you just have to let them go.
We love to get emails and calls about the home words that you've made, the words that belong to you and your loved ones. Call us 877-929-9673 or tell us the story in email to words@waywardradio.org. Hello, welcome to Away with Words.
Hi, my name is Mimi. I'm calling from Plattsmouth, Nebraska. When I was growing up, my grandmother would often use an expression kind of as an exclamation. It was good grief and little fishes. And she would kind of use it in a way that was like if she were really excited about something or if something was kind of like, you know, as an expression of disbelief, she would say good grief and little fishes. And nobody in my family, not my siblings or myself, really know where that came from. And she's no longer with us, so we can't ask her. But I've always wondered what the origin of that might be.
So you think of your grandmother and you think of this expression?
Yes, I sure do. She recently passed, and in her eulogy, both of my siblings and myself each mentioned it in her eulogy. So it clearly stuck with us.
Oh, how sweet. Yeah, it's not just her phrase, although it's not that common. I'm trying to imagine the reaction that she got when she would say that. Good grief and little fishes.
She was a elementary school teacher, and she said that, or one time she told us that in her one of her third grade classes, that a little boy asked her if she was upset after a few days because she hadn't made that expression in a few days. So she used it a lot.
I guess if you're around grade schoolers, that's a safe way of cursing without cursing.
And that sort of brings us to the more common version of this, which is ye gods and little fishes, which is an euphemism, you know, to express indignation or amazement or, you know, the kind of thing where she might say that. So, yeah, ye gods and little fishes is an older expression. And the shorter version of that is just ye gods. That's been around since probably the 17th century or so. And there are lots of different variations of this. Ye gods and little fishes, hell's bells and little fishes, ye cats and little fishes. Just a fun phrase. And I love her version of it, which you don't hear that often.
Great guns and great little fishes.
Mm.
I wonder what the fishes did to get such a bad rap.
I don't know. Some people have suggested that maybe the little fishes have to do with the story of Jesus feeding the 5,000 with two little fishes and five loaves. But we really don't know that. I think it's probably just a goofy saying.
Huh. Well, I love that. That fits right in with that's on brand, as they would say.
On brand.
It has been used by some writers of note. Louisa May Alcott uses it in Little Men, which was published in 1871. But out of school, ye gods and little fishes.